Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday. And we are going to be talking about finances again this hour. It really is dominating conversation everywhere in America. One of our guests this hour says, you have got massive public distrust and dissatisfaction with a bailout specifically, with government in general and George Bush and the entire political establishment. We're going to look at the Senate. They're going to be voting tonight on a revised version of this multi-billion dollar financial rescue plan. How many revisions are there? One of them, which has had a lot of press this week, is that the bill would raise the federal deposit insurance limits to $250,000 from $100,000 called for by both presidential nominees. But the American public is pretty upset about all of this. Is this the best financial bailout plan? What happens if it doesn't pass? How much money is it going to cost? What are the ramifications of a taxpayer bailout of this huge amount of money? We're going to be talking with two guests this hour and, of course, welcome your phone calls as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we have that email that you can use as well, which is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Professor Doug Muzio is a professor of public affairs at Baruch College in New York. Professor Muzio, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Professor Peter Federer, economics professor at McAllister College in Minnesota. Professor Federer, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Let's look at the revisions here and start with you, Professor Federer. Are there substantial Senate revisions to the earlier bill?
Well, I think the big one is the raising of the cap on FDIC insurance for banks from $100,000 to $250,000. I think I view that mainly as an attempt to, you know, reduce some of the panic and the fear to prevent depositors from running to the bank and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of a psychological an attempt to short-circuit this vicious cycle that we're in right now.
And does it make it more likely to get more support in Congress?
I would think so. I think from what I read in the paper that this is going to help push it through.
Mm-hmm. I was interested in your quote, Professor Muzio, that you have got massive public distrust and dissatisfaction with this bailout, and it is pretty big, isn't it?
It's huge. It is astronomical in terms of its size, exceeding at least the upfront cost of the Iraq War. And if you converted that $700 billion into goods, services, infrastructure, schools, etc., you could look at the opportunity costs here. That's not to say that some kind of rescue plan is not in order. It certainly is.
And a rescue plan like what's on the table right now or something?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, there are clearly the move on the FDIC deposits was a move to mitigate some of the criticism both from the public and from House Republicans and other legislators in Congress. But there is so much unknown here. It reminds me of William Goldman's remark about the movies. Nobody knows nothing. Even apologies to the good professor, practitioners of the dismal science.
Right. Is it true nobody knows nothing, Professor Federer?
Well, I that might be taking it a little far. I have an abiding faith in Ben Bernanke. I think he's a wonderful scholar, studied the Great Depression. And, you know, I trust him. I think he knows what he's doing. And I'm confident about that, at least.
You keep hearing these dire warnings. If we don't get something, the whole system is going down the drain, Professor Muzio.
I am not the economist, but at least what I'm reading, there is serious belief that this could have profound consequences. Again, what the consequences are, unintended, intended, etc., I don't know, and I haven't been convinced that anybody really knows. And even though that the chairman of the Fed, one can look at and say, yes, he's a scholar, he understands the Great Depression, I'm not quite sure about the Secretary of the Treasury, given his previous position and his activities on behalf of deregulation, for example.
And he still, Professor Federer, even with a revised bill, has an enormous amount of power here, doesn't he?
Well, initially it was going to be a blank check of $700 billion, which, and then over the last few days there's been more oversight added to that. And so it would be distributed in stages, and so that Congress would get an opportunity once it hit $200 billion to step in and evaluate what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Tell me why you think, and let's take the political aspect of this, Professor Muzio, why do you think this didn't pass Congress? It was a strange alignment of liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans who said no to this, and it looked as though the Republicans had enough votes initially. What went on?
Not being on the inside, it seems clear to me that George Bush is not only a lame duck, but he's a dead duck. And they're shooting bullets into the corpse. There was a revolt among House Republicans who, in a sense, you know, can't take it anymore. Mm. You know, we're back at another movie network. I mean, you know, that, you know, they were mad as hell and they weren't going to take it from Bush anymore. That's part of it. Part of it was a revolt against leadership. Part of it was, you know, the bubbling up of resentment and opposition from the public. There's a populist note here that sort of transcends parties, both from the right and the left, that it's the big Wall Street Eastern bankers again who are giving it to the rest of us. And I think there's this underlying populist resentment under here that Ron Paul tapped into, and that this banking crisis, if there were a spokesman out there, might be able to tap into.
Mm-hmm. What's your response to that, Professor Federer?
Yeah, I think, you know, Monday, if you looked at what happened, I think there was a kind of a populist revolt. We're not going to bail out these rich guys. And if you're a doctor, for example, and you make a mistake, you pay heavily in the form of a malpractice, for example. And so I think across the board, people resent this. And you know, the huge wages that these people earn, and then they make these big mistakes. On the other hand, I think people are starting to realize the potential cost to this, to everyone, in terms of a deep recession. And my view is that ultimately that is going to push us to do something.
At the risk of making this overly simplified, it is something that you're hearing in the presidential campaign, and these words regulation, deregulation. The market has been deregulated since Reagan and through the first Bush and also through Clinton. Can we look at this and say this is the effect of deregulation? Can we make it as simple as that for at least a major portion of the problem?
I think it's more complicated than that. I think, for example, we've gone through a long period of economic stability, and I think what that's done is it has caused people to take more risk or to perceive that there's less risk out there, and so that's driving this in part. I do think that regulation has become more lax under the Reagan administration, the Bush administration. So I think there are multiple factors here, and you know, but we've also benefited from deregulation as well. So I mean, it's 10 steps forward, one or two backward, and I think we're moving backward right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a question of wise regulation and regulation tailored to, you know, stated and clear public purposes. So it's, I think the professor's right. I mean, there are advantages and disadvantages of deregulation and regulation, but in part, the deregulation move, the ideology that Reagan articulated in his inaugural address, that government wasn't the solution to the problem, but the problem, mm-hmm. that paradigm might be shattered here.
Mm-hmm. What is it, let's go with you first, but I want to hear from both of you. What is it, Professor Muzio, that's going to sell this to the American people, that they may not like it, but they have to do it in order to keep the economy going in this country? Is there any way to soften this?
Yeah, pain. The way that the public, and myself included, is not only dire warnings of pain, but the actual, you know, sensation of pain. As Dr. Johnson said, the prospect of a hanging concentrates the mind wonderfully, and we're all looking at an economic hanging here, whether it's 401ks, other types of pensions. small businesses. I mean, there are serious economic consequences, as the professor has noted.
Mm-hmm. Professor Federer, same question to you.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen that just accelerate in the last 2 weeks after Lehman Brothers went down. I mean, the cost of credit is just skyrocketing, even to firms that are blue chip and historically have not had difficulties. And so we're really seeing some dramatic squeeze in credit markets, and I think people are beginning to see that and to fear that, and I think that's going to motivate folks to get behind it.
Yeah, and tell me more what that means, the cost of credit. There's not much credit available. How does that affect small businesses, people getting cars, et cetera?
Well, I mean, if anyone who takes out a consumer loan, a car loan, a student loan, mortgage for certain, is going to pay higher costs. Over the weekend, we saw many blue chip companies facing dramatic increases in their cost of credit on Monday and Tuesday. So, and as they do that, they're going to stop expanding, lay off workers, close plants, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests. Our number is 800-486-8655. There's a lot of concern about this. Our phone lines have been pretty much crowded since we started the program, and we'll also take emails. That's talk@wpr.org. Our guests this hour are Professor Peter Federer, who's an economics professor at McAllister College, Professor Doug Muzio, who's a professor of public affairs at Baruch College in New York. I'm Kathleen Dunn, to you in just a moment, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to you now. 800-486-8655 is the number. Matt from Lake Geneva, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm really against this bailout. I think it's a bailout of the elite's interests, and I think people really know this, and they're just being sold a bill of goods by the chattering classes and other people who are aligned with the elites. But I want to say that the automotive industry is a perfect example of why we should not have this bailout. The economy's been awash in a liquidity bubble, credit created by the Federal Reserve. And people have been flush with money to buy SUVs and stuff like that. The automakers, were pulling in money hand over fist on this, but they haven't made themselves competitive. And so now we've hit tough times, and they're crying that if they don't get these credits, they're going to go over the edge. Well, they've been living, in this artificial bubble, and it's all got to come down sometime, and it's better sooner than later.
Professor Federer, you want to start?
Well, there certainly is a lot of truth to the idea that, in the early part of this decade, there was too much liquidity. Greenspan lowered rates. He left them too low for too long. A lot of people believe that contributed to this bubble in the housing market. On the other hand, I think the parallel between, let's say, the auto industry and the financial industry is a dangerous one to make. I mean, there are a lot of spillovers, and we've been seeing those kind of play out here in the last 14 months. Within the financial sector, and if a car company goes under, that produces a lot of damage to a lot of lives. But the ability for spillovers to really make things dangerously bad is much more intense within the financial sector. So I would be very careful with that parallel.
Thanks very much for the call, Matt. Professor Muzio, how long should this bailout plan pass? How long do you imagine we're going to be in pretty tough economic times? I'm thinking of the new president who comes in, who obviously isn't going to have a heck of a lot of money to do much of anything, right?
Wait a minute. I'm one of those people who don't know nothing. So me projecting what are going to be the economic impacts is a mistake. I mean, clearly, if you do not have a substantial federal infusion of money, what the professor is talking about in terms of the credit squeeze and the consequent effects of that are going to be severe.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly they are and the duration, I just don't know.
Mm-hmm. And what about, I must ask, how this plays out politically? It seems to be benefiting, for whatever reason, please articulate what the reason would be, Senator Barack Obama.
Well, I think that, generally, the most general statement I can make is that economics tends to be the strength of Democrats, irrespective of what the election cycle is. And the secondly, that Obama has been talking about this for a fairly long time. Also, McCain has, you know, self-admitted his ignorance on the economy and then makes a statement a week before the system collapses that the fundamentals are sound. You compare that with his statements a week later and you see this dramatic shift. I mean, it's a well-sized flip-flop. It's a recognition of reality here. And I don't think McCain did very well in the debate on it. That's not to say that the economy is Obama's issue. It is the Democratic issue right now. It seems to be Obama's issue. But this is a very fluid situation, and we've got, you know, 30 some odd days here in the actions of the campaigns, reality out there. All kinds of things can happen.
Such as? I'm asking to predict again.
I mean, both within the economy and outside the economy. I mean, an international event, an act of terrorism, for example, might shift the entire tone of the debate away from the economy to national security. There's an infinite number of things that can happen that can inflect the course of this election.
Let's go to an email. This one goes to you, Professor Federer. I understand that the program that protects people's money in banks has been allowed to be underfunded. If there was a run on the bank, the fund does not have the money to cover as promised.
That's true, but they have a line of credit to the Treasury. So ultimately, the federal government is a backstop to the FDIC. But those funds come from the banks originally. They're insurance premiums that are charged at the banks that build up the fund and help pay off depositors at failed institutions. But if that fund is insufficient, the federal government stands behind it to support it, and ultimately the taxpayer.
Let's go to Nick from Park Falls. Hi, Nick.
Oh, hello, Kathleen. I'd like to make two, maybe three major points. Number one, Democrat Dave Ovey is the chairman of that big appropriations committee in the Congress, and he came here to Park Falls last January to give his little political speech. And for the first time in my life, I got up at one of those gatherings, and I addressed him thusly. I said, I have my 4-year degree in economics from the University of Madison, and I said, what's happening to the economy now in January is just scared the hell out of me. And I says, it's urgent that you do something about this. And I didn't want to leave him with the notion that I had no solutions. I said, maybe you need to look to what Franklin Roosevelt did with the Finance Reconstruction Corporation of the 1930s to save the American banking system. And when I mentioned Roosevelt's name, Obi perked up, and he says, yeah, that sounds like a wonderful idea. But then he said, I can't do anything because George Bush won't let me. In other words, we've had months and months and months to head off this crisis before it started. My second major point...
Wait, before you go to the second one, we need to take them one at a time or we'll forget. Or I'll forget. Professor Muzio, you want to respond to that?
The signs were there. Clearly there were people out there. John the Baptist, or Cassandra's, if you will, calling attention to that. But when it's rocking and rolling and you're in the, you know, the jazz age and then the hip-hop age, you know, with the amount of money out there, with the, you know, the cultural attitudes, it was ignored because there were a lot of people. And it's not only the bankers and the financiers, it's the public. I mean, let's start pointing fingers at ourselves in terms of our role in this crisis.
Nick, go on to point two.
Well, my second point is that my degree in economics is from the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and the professorial quality of teaching in the School of Economics there wasn't the greatest. It was kind of fair. The one really good teacher I had there was actually a socialist named Professor Meek, who was from Cambridge in England. And the thing is, I think the economics profession has really let down the American people. I mean, instead of teaching a small percentage of their class, undergraduates become billionaires on Wall Street. We need some sort of economic democracy here. We need the schools of economics across the country to align themselves in such a way that they teach ordinary Americans about the basic principles of economics, the law of supply and demand, about marginal costs, about opportunity costs, about how the banking system functions and how it's supposed to be regulated by the Federal Reserve. And last of all, these credit default swaps, I mean, that kind of thing should be against public policy. I mean, when you go to Las Vegas and you lose a bet with the casino, you cannot go to court to get your money back. These credit default swaps need to be against public policy. The people involved in this should not be able to go to the court system to enforce these contracts. This is just pure gambling.
Okay. Thanks, Nick, for the call. You want to defend your profession? I wonder how many billionaires you had as students are now on Wall Street, Professor Vetterer.
Well, not too many.
No.
But I'd like to go back to his first point. I think he's right on. I mean, this is not a new problem. This has happened throughout history. History is littered with examples of these kinds of wreckages in the financial system. You go back to the late 19th century, we would have these once a decade. The difference is, back then, there wasn't a big entity like the government to step in and help. And so we'd have these depressions that lasted 3 or 4 years. During the Great Depression, Andrew Carnegie, who was Secretary of the Treasury in 1929, made the argument that, you know, we need to just let liquidation happen, just let things fail, and the system would right itself eventually. It took us 3 years in January of 1932 to finally kind of happen upon the solution, which was to take these bad assets off the balance sheets of the banks. And since then, this has been done in Japan. It's been done in Scandinavia in the early 1990s. It was done in the U.S. in the 1980s with the S&L crisis. So we know... We know what the solution is to the kind of the immediate crisis. I mean, some of the debate we will have about regulation will be very interesting and so forth. But I think we have a pretty good handle on what we need to do right now. And then as far as the economics profession goes, I'm not sure what to say about that. I think we do a pretty good job. I think we do it at my institution, at least. And I think there's a lot of blame that can be spread broadly across America when it comes to this problem.
I don't think that many of us, and maybe we need to teach it as a standard course in high school or earlier, that we don't start studying this in school. I don't know. Some of us never study it in school.
Right. High schools have begun to offer courses in economics the last couple decades. But, I think there will be certainly a kind of a reassessment of finance and economics. I teach a course in behavioral economics, which is where economics and psychology meet. And my own view is that economics needs to listen to psychologists more. I hope we move in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Jeff next from Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Morning. I'm kind of amazed by the scope of the ripoff. I don't really have adjectives. I mean, colossal, gargantuan, $700 billion. To blame Greenspan, who's got his own blame for this mess, is to ignore the subprime heart of the mess in which the banks and other institutions bundled up these phony mortgages, knowing that people were not going to be able to pay for them when the escalator clauses set in. You have to go to Naomi Klein for a real answer and her shock doctrine analysis in her book, in which the neos, cons, and libs went and they followed the Reaganoid process of deregulation, privatize, and smash unions and smash workers. And it's coming home. It's a house of cards, and it's falling apart. And it deserves to fall apart because the bundling of those mortgages at the heart of this crisis was a crime. It was a con game done by the big money people. And part of the problem is the media. Corporate-controlled media is just not taking this collapse of a house of cards in any way except let's see what we can do to make these people whole, which is a joke.
Thanks, Jeff, for the call. Professor Federer. Or no, Musial, let me go to you on that.
I understand the anger. I've expressed similar attitudes myself and vented and taken my blood pressure medicine, et cetera. But the bottom line is the old adage about noses and spiting of faces. Yeah, I agree fundamentally with his analysis. I share his populist views. But you are in this situation. What do you do? I would love to have a cost-free situation where the malefactors will suffer either economically or politically or in terms of jail time. But something needs to be done about the mess.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to an email. Professor Federer, starting with you, I heard a guy on Charlie Rose last night. I think he was suggesting that we, the public, would be shareholders in this bailout and that the shareholders might actually profit. What's your take on this?
Well, I think the plan as it's designed at this point is not to be a shareholder, but rather so the federal government is not going to buy shares of stock in these troubled banks, but rather is going to buy the bad assets, the toxic assets off the balance sheets of these banks. Now, at some point, the federal government will turn around and sell those back into the market, hopefully when things settle down and there isn't such a flight to liquidity. And we could end up realizing, a gain on these securities. But it depends on what price we buy them at and what price they eventually are sold back to the public.
And how long would it take for that to happen, or do we not know?
Well, with the SNL bailout, we started that in 1989, and by 1995, that had come to an end. So it took about 6 years to take those assets out of the economy and then eventually put them back into the economy.
6 years?
Yes.
That's a long time.
And wasn't it a considerably smaller amount of money, ultimately, than
right.
what we're talking about now, even in the short term?
Yeah, I think they were talking about a $500 billion problem, and it ended up being somewhere around $200 billion.
Edward from Lake Geneva, hi.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question for either one of the two, I guess. In looking at this bailout plan that more than likely will be approved in the next couple of days, in looking at it overall, I do not see any provisions in there that will help or assist the regular Main Street person. By that I mean, like myself, I continue to make my mortgage payments, although they're pretty high, I have not defaulted. Are there any provisions that either one of them are aware in that plan that will assist us to continue making the payments, maybe reduce them, maybe reducing the interest rate? And my number two question is, are there any sites in the Internet that we can go to look at this plan, line item by line item, so that we are fully aware, we, the ones that are going to pay, aware of what it is exactly that has been approved? And I will take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Edward. Whoever wants to respond.
Well, on the first point, I don't think there's anything in there that will directly affect you in terms of relief for interest payments of any sort. But the idea here is that it will indirectly affect you by helping the macroeconomy stabilize and prevent it from going into recession so that you can service your debts and you don't become unemployed.
Let's go to an email. This morning, I've had emails kicked back as undeliverable. I called, this is somebody who's been sending emails to his congressman for quite some time. I called Ron Kind's office, and he said that they're having a whole breakdown of the email system in D.C. because of the sheer volume of emails coming in. People are mad. People need to just overwhelm these guys. My personal feeling on this whole idea of it being a rescue plan is that it is simply lipstick on a pig of a proposal for the pig class. Woo! Professor Musio.
Pretty strong talk out there. I can understand the massive contact by the public into elected officials. You might have break the record, I guess, that was set during the Watergate days. People are, they're upset, they're fearful, they're angry, they're, you name the emotions of turmoil, mm-hmm. and they these are the folks that they're talking to. They're going to their elected representative, and obviously what's happening is they're overwhelming the technical capability of the system there. The people are angry. Now, whether this anger, you know, is simply cathartic or it has real consequences, here is the question.
Consequences such as?
Well, I mean, consequences such as the latest plan gets killed.
I see. What do you think about that, Professor Federer?
Well, I hope it doesn't.
I hope
people view this plan as an imperfect solution to a mess that we are in, and people will step back and support it.
We go to Edith next from Madison. Hello, Edith.
Yes, thank you, Kathleen. Early on in your program, there was discussion of part of this new plan, including raising the coverage of FDIC to $250,000. And I believe that in all of these discussions, by using the language of just referring to any entity as a bank is very misleading. FDIC really only covers commercial banks, the banks where most of us have our money. FDIC does not regulate the investment firms on Wall Street, which everybody seems to be referring to as a bank. They're not really banks. They need their own regulations. The second point I want to raise is that I have heard absolutely no one on radio or TV refer to what is going on in the credit market, which is usury. Congress repealed the laws that prohibited usury. And so many millions of Americans have suffered because lenders have, after contracts were signed, have raised rates to usurious levels.
Professor Federer, you want to start? Thanks very much for your call, Edith.
Well, I think in many cases it's built into the contract that they can raise rates. Let me give you an example. Circuit City, which is a big retailer of manufactured goods, this week their debt payments were increased by $2 million because it is tied to their long-term debt interest payment is tied to the LIBOR rate, which is set in London. And so that's part of the contract. That's one of the reasons that this squeeze in credit we're seeing is harmful, because it's putting Circuit City, for example, in a tough spot. On the earlier point about the FDIC, there were reports earlier in the week about companies who had deposits at banks taking those deposits out and putting them in other banks to ensure that all of their deposits were below the $100,000 limit, so that all of their deposits would be covered. Mm-hmm. And I think that's another one of the problems that we're seeing out there, and the $250,000 limit that they're now talking about will alleviate that and reduce that inefficiency in the economy.
Mm-hmm. Hey, let's talk about fairness and suffering for a little while, Professor Muzio, because that's an issue that's at play here as well. There is something striking about these people walking away with $30 million severance packages and getting really rich when you've got people who can't pay home heating bills, when gas prices are high, when people are going to work every day, sometimes doing two jobs and are barely getting by. Then there's something fundamentally unfair about that, and this is America, for heaven's sake.
Excuse me. I mean, you know, let's do the call to arms now and storm the barricades. I agree. I mean, I'm one of those people who've got mortgage payments, you know, credit card bills, etc. I fully understand the anger, and I understand the massive number of emails and phone calls into the Capitol. But I mean, you go back to the founding fathers. I mean, the reason why they established the representative government that they did is they didn't trust the people. They didn't want them angry and passionate, so they created a representative government to act as a filter. So it's embedded politically in the regime. They knew that we would be angry, and what they created a system that allowed us to channel our anger but not overthrow the system very often.
Let's go to an email from Megan in Rhinelander. Can you speak, Professor Federer, about alternatives to the proposed bailout? Dennis Kucinich was on MSNBC last night speaking about some. Why aren't these being more seriously considered?
Well, one alternative is to let the kind of the private banking system handle this, and that is to let the healthier banks, Citigroup and Bank of America, for example, to step in and buy the weaker ones. I think we've gotten to a point where they have kind of done as much as they can do at this point, and so we're turning to kind of the government here to be the buyer of last resort, at least temporarily, hopefully. So, you know, for 14 months, the Fed has been aggressively engaged in trying to liquefy the balance sheets of banks, hoping that that would solve the problem. They've addressed the crisis one bank at a time as it has gone under. They let Lehman Brothers fail 2 weeks ago, hoping to send a message, and things have gotten worse since then. So I think we're at this point because we have, over the last year and a half, in kind of a piecemeal way, been attempting to deal with this. And we are now at the point where other countries and where we have found ourselves historically on occasion. And I think we need to move forward.
More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, you use that same number. And if you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, last weekend, 5,500 college admission officials and high school guidance counselors got together in Seattle to look at things like the ethics of tracking student applications on Facebook. But most people were interested in the first public presentation of the findings of the study of the use of standardized tests in undergraduate admission. And we'll be looking at whether or not colleges and universities need to examine their use of the SAT and the ACT and to consider whether the benefits outweigh the disadvantages or whether they can make the tests optional for admissions. Our guest this hour, Professor Doug Muzio, Professor of Public Affairs at Baruch College in New York, Professor Peter Federer, Economics Professor at McAllister, and we are talking about the multi-billion dollar financial rescue plan. The Senate is supposed to pass that tonight. It's a revised version of that. We'll see what the House does, and we're talking about what it all means. And we go next to Joe from Wausau. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I've been trying to get on the air for quite some time to talk about this. Let me tell you why I want this bill to fail, and I want the economy to collapse. My entire life, I've paid rent. I don't have health insurance, and I work 60 hours a week. I work as hard as I can to get by, but I just can't seem to climb that ladder of success. And the main reason is the only way I can ever afford anything is to take credit. For some reason, we've decided that credit is the best way to go and not paying people a decent wage. And I really think that if the economy just finally collapses and more people feel the pain that I have felt every day of my adult life, that maybe I'm going to get some sympathy. Maybe it's going to cause a tidal wave of social change. Maybe it'll make people a little bit more liberal. And maybe, just maybe, if less people can afford health care, less people can afford food, less people can afford their houses, it'll make people a little bit more sympathetic to all the people suffering out there already. It's just ridiculous. I don't know. There's a whole list of things, but I don't know. I'm just too worked up to really get them out of my mind. So I guess I'll just let you respond to that, and that I just really feel that I wish that more people felt the pain that I feel. And I see this as a good thing, a positive thing for social change.
Thanks for the call. Professor Muzio.
I wish I could be that optimistic that there would be, you know, societal changes both in terms of policy and attitude, because I share the much of the caller's view. It ain't going to happen. The system will absorb this. It will be diffused, and things will pretty much go on. I mean, the professor knows much more about economic history and how economic cycles can have profound effects. I mean, clearly, the Great Depression had profound effects on the nature of government involvement, the nature of the economy, the role of consumption, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So these changes can occur. Is this one of those times? I'm not quite sensing that, but this is early in the game.
Professor Federer.
Well, I understand the point, and I often think a cold shower is helpful sometimes to wake one up and to look at the world with greater precision and clearness. On the other hand, I fear that a deep contraction can also unleash political forces that would not be in the direction that the caller has suggested. Fascism came to power during the Great Depression. Germany suffered from a Great Depression just like the U.S. did. It was as nearly as severe. And so I don't think you can predict that a deep contraction is going to lead to a more progressive political regime.
We go to Mike next from Oshkosh. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hi. I think the reason that the public are about 80-1 against this plan is because it's too complex. People don't understand derivatives and mortgage-backed bundled securities and all, you know, the very complicated economic principles at play. I wish we would get some leadership, mostly from McCain and Obama, and talk about the four-letter word that's the underpinning of this entire mess, and that is debt. We are the only industrialized nation in the world that has a negative savings rate. From the individual to the corporate to government, we don't pay for anything. We just borrow it. And if we don't, I don't know to what extent this plan would help turn that Titanic around, but if it does, I'd be for it. But if it doesn't, I would not. Do the guests know if there is any possibility that this plan would help us address that four-letter word, and I'll take my comment off the air.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Mike. Who wants to take it?
Well, the economist should definitely go first.
Okay.
there are some – when you look at this problem, it didn't just happen overnight. There are longer-term forces at work here, and one of them is what the caller is speaking to, and that is the abysmal savings rate in the United States, both at the kind of the household level and at the government level, and this goes back, you know, to the early 1980s. And he's right. I mean, the U.S. personal savings rates have been zero, and in some cases negative. So that is part of the problem here. That's why the debt. If you look at debt to GDP ratios, we're at historic highs at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Now, will this plan do anything to solve that? There's nothing in it, as far as I can see, to address the undersavings of America. I think we need to take a hard look. Maybe this will be a cold shower in terms of that dimension of the problem, and we will, going forward, both at kind of the government level and the personal level, think about savings in a different way.
Professor Muzio.
Again, the diagnosis is right on. I don't know what the prescription is. It doesn't seem that you're going to have a massive cultural attitudinal shift to more prudence. The whole generational mindsets and economic sense has been one of, you know, conspicuous and massive consumption. And it seems as if it's embedded in our social psychology here. And I don't know how you break that addiction to spending and debt.
Let's go to Scott from Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. Yeah, I have two quick questions. One, I'm wondering if the Fed exacerbated this problem throughout the last 2 years with being overly concerned about inflation as opposed to a deflationary spiral. I think the Fed should have been loosening credit as opposed to tightening it. That's one point question. The other one is how much does the individual consumer come to blame in this? I mean, you were talking about conspicuous consumption, and since we've got an issue in the mortgage market, my opinion has been is that we're a selfish, greedy nation, and people want to keep up with the Joneses. And you have so many people that took out mortgages they just couldn't afford. And when rates went up, and you're talking adjustable rates going up a couple of points for the most part, if that caused you to go into default, you had a house that you couldn't afford to pay to start with. And I think there are too many people that get over their head because they want everything now. We want instant gratification, and we want more. And I think that is a systemic problem that really needs to be addressed, and I don't know how you even do it.
Professor Federer, thanks, Scott, for the call.
Mm-hmm. On the Fed point, you know, the Fed funds rate has gone down from about 5.25 to 2. The Fed balance sheet, until very recently, has not expanded a great deal. So they haven't, up until the last few weeks, been pouring money at the problem. What they have been doing is extending the length of their loans to commercial banks, attempting to give banks more time to deal with their illiquid assets. I think that's changing. I think the Fed is becoming more loose. I actually think the Fed has done a pretty good job during this crisis. Not quite sure what we're going to do about the savings, that problem that the second caller alluded to. You know, I think we lived through a period of rising housing prices, and I think people were led to believe that prices would continue to rise, and that is part of the problem, and that is part of the reason that standards were loosened so much when it came to getting a mortgage, and that's put us into this problem.
Mm-hmm. Is American greed at the heart of this as well? Do you agree, Professor Mizuto?
Yeah, I mean, clearly there is this, I mean, from early, I mean, post-World War II consumption. I mean, the mechanisms and the mindset of mass consumption is embedded in the psychology. And again, as I said before, I don't know how you get around that. I mean, clearly, Pogo's right. You got to look in the mirror and say, I am part of the problem. I'm a small part of the problem, and I'm suffering because there are greater malefactors out there, but I'm part of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Let's take an email here. What do we know about the financial condition of insurers in the consumer lines of business, like life, property, and casualty, firms like State Farm, et cetera, Northwestern Mutual, and large consumer insurers would certainly have had portfolio exposure through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I haven't heard any discussion about their financial condition. Professor Federer?
I have not either, and to be frank, it's been hard to keep up with the news as
right.
It pours out about all these institutions. But I haven't heard, other than AIG, you know, that's been the big one, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard bad news about other insurance companies.
Bruce from Kenosha, and we're running short on time, everybody. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. Interesting show. I'm just on my way to work, but I'll just throw out a question and then maybe a quick follow-up, or I'll give you guys something else to ponder as a solution. I think part of the problem that people are really angry about is that the proposal is to give this mass amount of funding to, and for lack of a better term, it's always Wall Street. I think people would be more comfortable if Wall Street was clearly defined. Number one, which are the firms that need this money and how badly do they need it in what amounts? My question is this solely based, would you say, on the overextension of the mortgage industry for these bad home loans?
Okay, thanks, Bruce. We'll ponder that as you get on your way to work. Professor Mizuto?
It is that, but it is much more than that. It is, you know, this inextricably intertwined web that really defines the economic system. And if and structures it, and without the movement that the professor talked about in terms of loosening up the credit, you're going to have a severe, severe contraction, and we're all going to get hurt. So something clearly has to be done along the general lines that have been proposed. Again, as I said earlier, who knows what the ultimate ramifications and impacts of this, whether success in the short, long, or midterm.
Mm-hmm. Professor Federer, you get the last word here, 20 seconds.
Well, the proximate cause of all this is the mortgage market. But the deeper causes, which Professor Muzio has done a nice job of articulating, are driving that, kind of the cultural causes, the loose monetary policy of the early part of the century, the under savings. And I think when people point the finger here at the Wall Street folks, at the economists, at the politicians, I think everyone needs to look in the mirror here and think about, you know, their savings and their behavior as well.
Yeah. Thank you both so much. It was a great hour. Thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Our thanks to Professor Peter Federer, economics professor at McAllister College, Professor Doug Muzio, professor of public affairs at Baruch College in New York. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to Katie Madsen for on-air production here in Milwaukee, and thanks for all of your extremely informed phone calls. You can be sure we'll be on this issue again. News is coming up. We'll return with another hour of Wednesday morning conversation here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.